Hi, my name's Daniel, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Daniel.
And I really have no idea what's going to come out, so bear with me. I really don't get nervous until I stand up here and I start looking at y'all, and at that point, I'm kind of wondering what the heck's going to come out. So we'll see what's going on. My sobriety date is 2008, January 19 or 20, depending on how you look at it. You know, I wound up, I think, 20 locked up, and 19, I believe, was the last drink I had. So I don't know which one of those it is, so it's somewhere in that gray area. I've heard a lot of people tell their stories, okay? And sometimes when I'm sitting where you guys are sitting, I actually have a tear come to my eye, because when some people start sharing their stories, it's hard to imagine not winding up an alcoholic, because some of us go through some hell before we even take that first drink. It's hard for me to imagine some of the things that I've had the experience of getting to know. And with me, absolutely none of that's true. I lived a pretty stellar childhood. My parents were, religious folks. We didn't even have alcohol around the house. Lived in a real small agrarian community outside, about 45 minutes outside of D.C., northwest of D.C., and, here in Georgia, I like to hear how everybody, says they lived in a small town and you guys think you got redneck cornered, but come out to northwest Maryland. And to show you how small town we celebrated when I was in high school getting the first stoplight that was at the two roads that cross in our town. Rest of it was farmland, okay? But that's part of what made it such a stellar childhood. My old man loved motorbikes, and I had a motorbike since the time I was a little kid. And for 30 miles from Braddock Mountain to South Mountain, there was nothing but farmland. And for a kid in a motorbike, that's pretty much a dream world, you know? My father and mother were strict. They taught me absolutely everything that I rebelled against. And I can honestly say only after coming to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous did I realize that everything Mom and Dad tried to teach me was spot on. So I didn't even have my first drink until I had graduated high school, and we had a senior party out on one of the farms, and there was a keg there, and I had some beer, and because I had never had any beer, I had no idea what beer was all about, and there wasn't even really any kind of white light epiphany where I drank the beer and immediately felt comfortable. I mean, I grew up in a high school that we all knew each other, and we all knew each other from the time we were little kids, so I never really felt like an outcast. I got along with everybody. I played, I played soccer, so I got along with the jocks. I had a motorbike and knew a lot about motors, so I got along with the gearheads, and, I just pretty much hung out with everybody. I kind of floated around and did my own thing. First drink, nothing spectacular. I think it kicked off when I started school in the big city, Baltimore. I went to Towson State, and when I got down to Baltimore, I realized there was a lot more out there than, motorbikes and farmland, And I started drinking like I said, there was really no, oh, this is the magic elixir kind of thing. I just started drinking and partying because I was in college, and that's what I thought we did in college. And I can't even, you know, a lot of folks will say they can know where they cross the line into alcoholism. I can't tell you when that was. It evolved into an absolute depraved sickness. That's what I know. I have a propensity for excess, right? I go hard or I go home. And we did that from the time I was a little man. You know, my dad would take us, we'd load our motorbikes up, and we'd head up into York, and we'd go into some abandoned quarries, and we'd unload them. And there was two things I had to tell Dad before I geared up and got on my motorbike. And what are the two rules, son? And it was me and my brother. I have an older brother. And we had to say, if you're going to, you're going to be dumb, you got to be tough. And if you go off the motorbike, go limp and take the hit. And I live by those today, you know. It really works. If I see something coming at me and it's going to be tough, don't try to brace myself because I'm going to screw myself up more, you know. Started at Towson. Towson's in Baltimore. That's about half an hour, 45 minutes to the coast. I hooked up with a guy named Keith Collins, whose dad grew up on the coast, and he introduced me to surfing. And being hindsight's 20/20, right? So I know now why I did some of the things I did, and that's because I'm a you know, an alcoholic, and I have stinking thinking, right? I tried for about 2 weeks straight down at the ocean, south side of Indian River Inlet to stand up on that stupid thing. And when I finally did, I was kind of hooked. So I actually decided that school wasn't for me, you know. Moving to the ocean was for me, and that started a little over a decade of just completely self-indulged, transient, nomadic, just idiocy, right? It was completely self-involved. I was completely self-involved. All I really cared about was, you know, if the swell was up here, I would literally tell my bosses. I worked carpentry and I slung liquor over the bar, which are two jobs that you can do pretty much at any beach town you get into, you know. If you can swing a hammer well and sling some liquor, you got a spot somewhere. And I would tell my bosses, you know, if it's over 3 or 4 feet, you know, don't expect to see me at work. So, you know, if I'm not there, if you look and the swell's up, that means I'm not going to be there. And it was completely self-involved, you know. And I thought because I would tell you that I'm a, you know, self-involved, self-centered prick, then it was okay. You know, because I was being honest, you know. And one of the things my dad used to tell me is, you know, Daniel, an honest asshole is still an asshole. You know. And those kind of things ring true with me. Because, like I tell you, I can't tell you where I crossed that line because my propensity for excess meant that, you know, when I was drinking. So, I mean, I was going to drink. And I also would indulge absolutely anything that came along with drinking, you know. So I'm a very big fan of singleness of purpose, okay? But I also have a couple workarounds. And my workaround is some of my alcohol came in baggies, right? And some of my alcohol came in pill bottles. It was whatever you had with you when we were out doing our thing. And I can honestly tell you the alcohol was the thing. Everything else was ancillary, you know. It was alcohol. I didn't even realize that I was evolving into an alcoholic. I would go home to visit my mom. I always had my parents always had my back, which, being the youngest of four, I was spoiled, right? And so whenever I would go out and screw up, I always knew that all I had to do was call Pops and say, "Hey, you know, I'm headed back home." Always open, door always open. So it was somewhat of a form of enabling, right? But my parents had no idea they were enabling. They were just doing what their parents did for them, you know. But they didn't realize because their parents weren't raising a flaming alcoholic. I mean, I was just hard at it. Absolutely, you know, the harder I could go, the more I liked it. I eventually wound up down in Florida, a place called Ormond Beach, Florida, which is just north of Daytona, okay? And I was drinking one night, and a buddy of mine had come up with some alcohol that was in a bag that we could eat. And so I ate some of that alcohol and got on my motorbike and I started riding around. And closest I can remember is that there were a lot of abandoned houses that developed personalities while I was on this motorbike ride. And I started become fascinated with the abandoned houses, and the next day I realized there was a lot of abandoned houses. So I worked at a bar at the time, the Golden Lion, and there was this really, really well-to-do architect who was a regular, and I started talking to him about these houses because, you know, in my head they had personalities, and it was because, you know, if you've been down in Florida, you have the mold and things growing, and, you know, when you're eating the things I was eating, everything develops a personality. Well, at least in my world, it did. And I started talking to him about all these houses, and I said, there's a lot of them. And he explained to me that in Florida, a certain percentage of our population wants to retire and go to Florida. So the man and the woman, when they retire, they come down to Florida. But a percentage of those people, one of them dies and the other one does not want to be alone in Florida. So they go back home. So there's a stock of abandoned houses at any given time in Florida. So I got the brilliant idea I was going to put together a form letter and just go out on my motorbike and take note of where all these houses were. And I had a letter where I sent like 20 letters out. And I go down to the municipal building and figure out who was on the deed and find where they are according to their tax information, where they were sending their taxes. And I would send these form letters and offer them money for these houses. It was kind of cooked up between this architect and I. And he said, you know, Daniel, if you get them done, if you can say you'll have this house remodeled in X amount of time, I'll foot the bill, we'll split it 50-50. I said, sweet, okay? And out of the first crop of letters I sent out, I got 4 responses, and I was offering absolute dirt cheap. I was offering for a house, and what I did was I picked houses that were all solid block exteriors. So I was offering, but they were completely desecrated, abandoned, some of them holes in the roof. And okay, so I offered less than the property was worth for the property with the house. Long story short, what happened is that became successful, and I got a check for $30,000. And if there is any time where I could tell you that where I entered into alcoholism, it was around that time. Because with a guy like me who had really never had anything, I really didn't care about money. I didn't, you know, try to stack my chips. I wasn't obsessed with material things. I've driven an old school Jeep all my life. I still drive one today. I never got into that. So my best thought with $30,000 was, okay, I'm going to quit working for a while and blow this money and party my ass off. And when it got down, I just pulled the next letter. And that's when my life, and like I said, I don't know exactly when it was. That was like 4 or 5, I can't even really tell you what years they were, because, you know, at that point I was just drinking and partying as much as I possibly could. And I had found a way to put enough coin in the bank where I didn't really have to work. I had a crew of guys. I'd pull a dumpster on. I'd have a crew of guys that would go in and completely demolish the house. I'd go in and write up where the walls were, make some measurements, draw a quick print where the walls were, tell them to trash it, throw it in that dumpster, and we'd rebuild it. And I was making good money. And I used that to go back home and decided I was going to open my own, you know, hang my own shingle in my hometown and build some houses. And I went up there with a considerable amount of cash, opened my own business, and within 5 years of that, I was staying in a two-room basement apartment that was close enough to the bars on Market Street that I could walk there. I had absolutely lost everything. And it was, I was still, you know, pretty stubborn. You know, I was still not willing to admit I had a problem with alcohol, even though I didn't have, you know, 20 cents in the bank. My mom and dad were absolutely distraught because I was scaring the hell out of them, you know, and I thought it was It was because I was just being absolutely stupid. I wasn't respecting anybody that loved me at all. Wasn't even close to respecting anybody that loved me. And it was horrible. And I didn't even realize how horrible it was until I got sober. And I have the rooms Alcoholics Anonymous to thank for letting me see how horrible I was. I was a human that had nothing to be proud of. I didn't have a damn thing to be proud of. I mean, it was just a whole lot of nothing in my life. And I was not even close to admitting it. At that point, my brother called me up one time and asked me, he was opening a business here in Georgia, and asked me to come down because there was a part of the business that he knew that I would be able to help him facilitate. And, I mean, here I was. I didn't even have a license, okay? the different states, I mean, my alcoholism got so bad that I would decide how long I was going to live in a state based on whether that state was reciprocal to other states where I had DWIs, right? I would do a little research before I'd even move in and set up, you know, camp in that state. You know, are they, do they communicate with this state? Because I got one, two in this state, I can't go into that. And that's, I mean, how it, my whole life had gotten to a point where I was a slave to my addiction. And I thought I was living free. I was transient, you know, nomadic out there, living some sort of romantic lifestyle in my head where I was free. But I was enslaved by my addiction. They drove absolutely everything I did. So my brother called me up and asked me, you know, said, I need your help down here to do this. And I said, oh, of course, yeah, I'll come down and help my brother. I mean, I didn't even have a license, right? I said, yeah, I'll come down and help you, but I have some things I have to work out here. And that was, when the hell am I going to be able to make it legal for me to even drive down to Georgia, you know? And I asked him for a timeline, figured out how I was going to get my license, wound up coming down here. But there was a preface given to me by my big brother, another person in my life. All my family, we're real tight. We love each other. Again, I was completely disrespecting anybody that loved me. And it came with conditions. I could come down here, but I couldn't party the way I partied. He knew the way I partied. I wasn't an alcoholic who hid my alcohol. You know, I didn't hide it around the house or anything. I mean, it was there. I really didn't dispute. I remember sitting in a bar, and my Uncle Greg, from my mom's side, we weren't allowed to hang out with my mom's brothers. And I know now it's because they were all alcoholics, probably part of the lineage. But I remember him sitting down, coming up beside me in a bar when I was back in my hometown, and he said, I see you're Snyder, because I had a tall Newcastle brown ale with a kicker of Grand Marnier. That's the way I drank all the time. I didn't, you know, if I had a beer, I had to have it backed up with some sort of hard stuff because, I mean, the beer was for the pansies, right? So he asked me to come down. I guess I'm getting like a crack in the windshield type of thing. He asked me to come down, and I wound up coming down here to Georgia and agreeing to not drink and party like I wanted to. Shouldn't be a problem, right? Well, it was a problem. I was down here in Georgia, and I white-knuckled it for 6 months straight. And I can remember obsessing about going back home. Before I moved down here, I wound up living on a commune outside of D.C. Where the lady had, she was a lobbyist for the natives. And so they would all come hang out there, and I was like, wow, this is a real cool place to live. Bunches of natives and... That's where I lived before I came down here. And when I was down here for those 6 months, I obsessed. And on that commune, let me tell you, though, you know, drinking and the other alcohol that came in bags was absolutely just everywhere. You know, none of us really, we all partied the same. And that was as hard as we possibly could. And we did as little work as we possibly could. As long as we got X, Y, and Z done, that's all we cared about. And so I had this plan that I was going to do exactly what I told my brother, but when I went back, I would, you know, cut loose. And that was for Christmas, January 2008. And by the time I came back here to Atlanta, by the 19th, I was locked up. I went home, and I had put some coin in the bank because I didn't do anything but work. And I went home, and I blew all that and partied the way I like to party. And when I came down here, I decided I was going to get my own neighborhood bar. Wound up there. Long story short, wound up locked up in 19 days after I decided, okay, you know, I got this on lockdown. I'm going to need to start drinking again. Wound up locked up. That's where I always wound up. I had a, you know, I didn't like the law, so, you know, I kind of, I always fought the law, and they always won. And so I would wind up locked up. I wasn't afraid to tell them whatever I thought was they needed to know. And that's when I got introduced to the program, because I was down here in Atlanta. I had separated myself from all the people I had blamed my entire life because it was all them. I was hanging out the wrong crowd, you know. And I was here where I had absolutely no one to blame but myself. And I remember laying on that rack, staring up at the ceiling, locked up again. And I said, I got to do something, you know. And my brother introduced me to a guy named David, who took me to my first meeting at Burn Hickory Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't even, you know, at that point, I thought you guys would maybe show me how to deal with the fact I couldn't drink. I had no idea of a life that was happy, joyous, and free. I didn't know how I could wrap my head around happy, joyous, and free of alcohol. You know, to me, it was impossible. I just couldn't even fathom living without partying and being happy, joyous, and free. I thought y'all were full of stuff, right? It's like, okay, you know, everybody's fronting. You're not really down with not drinking. You're just pretending. And so I came to the meetings that were on my slip. I had to get the slip signed. And I actually came to the meetings, and I started. I have somewhat of an analytical side of my head that likes to figure things out. And I started taking notes in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I started trying to prove y'all wrong, right? And the people around me thought I was really being studious and trying to really get this thing, because I always had, I mean, I had this floppy hat, I didn't want to see anybody, and I had my notes, and I was actually writing T postulates, which is a way to prove logic. If you say this, then this. If this is true, then this. Right? And so I would go down through it, you know, you have to surrender to win. I would be taking notes on all the BS that people were saying about this stuff because y'all were not even telling the truth, right? And I was writing in that book about how y'all were full of BS, and this old-timer named Terry C. looked me straight in the eye, and he said, only when you start to recognize the similarities and ignore the differences will you make a turn in this thing. And the first thing that went through my head was, this son of a bitch has been reading my book. And he wasn't. He had seen one or two of me come in rooms, and he was trying to help me out. You know, you people have done nothing but try to help me out since I came in the room, regardless of how much of an asshole I wanted to be about it. Period. You did nothing but help me. And I thank you for that on a daily basis. My life, since that time, got better by the day. And there was no way for me to deny that it was because I wasn't drinking, and I was starting to give a damn about other people. It was very small. They had me, you know, my sponsor had me doing all this service work, and I started becoming proud of the things I was doing, no matter how small they were, because I was a complete waste before. So any small thing I was doing to help anybody else out gave me a sense of pride. And it wasn't the pride that the Bible talks about making you bad. You know? It was I was actually proud to be a human. You know? I was proud to be living. And my life got better, like I said, by the week and by the day. I just remember things happening that were better. My life used to be, I couldn't even stay in this spot too long because it would get so crappy, I'd have to roll up out of there to get to someplace else, you know? And my life just got better. I remember constantly my entire life thinking that folks talked about crying tears of joy. And I was like, what kind of crap is that? I mean, who bawls when they're happy? It was stupid, right? I couldn't even fathom it until I got one of the greatest blessings of this program. And that is someone that loves me enough to be with me the rest of my life. And loves me enough to have children with me. And when I was in the delivery room, I cut the umbilical cord. And they took her away, and I was just doing my thing, you know, talking to Jill. Oh, my God. Just a freaking human being born. And, you know, I was just like, wow. And that nurse came over and handed me my daughter, Isabel, and I was bawling uncontrollably. And I was just like looking around, and all the nurses were bawling. I was bawling. And I finally understood what tears of joy were. And I have them on a regular basis now because I'm grateful to be alive. You know, I'm grateful that I met each and every one of you who taught me that I was a self-involved prick. And if I quit trying to serve myself, I'm going to be happy. And it was just, right? It was like, yeah, right, people. You know, help everybody else. Yeah, you know. I had pretended for so long to be some kind of utopian dream, hippie, wanderer, whatever, right? But, I mean, that was just justifications for doing what I was doing. One of the things I really thought was cool about coming to this meeting, I have to actually make amends to this entire meeting because Steve asked me to do this, to tell my story a couple weeks back. And it was a couple months after the second little man, my daughter, and then we have another new addition, little man. We had some issues with him, and I completely spaced and did not show up here to tell my story. That's completely my fault, so I'm apologizing to y'all. I try to honor my commitments. I didn't even realize that I didn't show up here until everything kind of calmed down with the little man, and it was all cool. It was, you know, new parents making a big deal over nothing, and so. For that, I'm sorry. One of the cool things about this meeting was that while you guys are doing your thing, I hear the word service constantly, all right? And anytime when I came to you guys' group conscience. You were focused on service. And there is no doubt in my mind that without the service I've done, I wouldn't be as spiritually fit as I am today. I realized very quickly that helping other people really helped me a lot more than I ever helped myself. And if I can get out of the way and let the old man work out all the details, my life is pretty phenomenal, right? And so my sponsor made it very clear to me that I had to do service. I had to give back to the program that gave me my life back, period. Pretty simple, you know, one equals the other. And so I have stayed involved in service in some way, shape, or form. I'm not the guy who has, 20,000 sponsees and whatever. I got a couple. We're real tight. We keep the game going as best we can and help each other out. And I found that it's more of a symbiotic relationship than anything else. Those cats are helping me a lot more than I'm helping them. I can tell you that right now. Because without them, I wouldn't know what it's like. It'd keep me fresh in the steps and the traditions and trying to live a life that is enabling me to cry tears of joy, you know? The service work, I thought, was a major pain in the ass, right? Because nobody did it the way I thought they should do it, right? And I had heard people say, it's all a bunch of political crap, and blah, 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 because I'm involved in the general service structure of AA. And my sponsor told me, you know, we want to keep the integrity of the program. You know, do your part, whatever you can, to make sure this is still around for the people who are coming after you. And first couple conferences I went to down in Macon, I was like, these people just argue about a whole lot of nothing. And if you want to see how slow an entity can roll, go down to the GSSA. Because snails will kick their ass, right? And in the past 2 years have I learned, right? Again, the old man doing for me what I can't do for myself. Our delegate and I were talking, and I was complaining about how damn slow everything is, right? And he said, Daniel, how quick do you think a group of alcoholics could mess something up? And I was like, and how bad do you think we could mess it up? And I was like, and he said, so, you know, there's a purpose for everything. And from then on, man, I was happy as hell to be there. Yeah, it's slow, right? It's slow, but hey, we don't want to screw this thing up, man, so we better take our time and we better talk about it. It's also, since I developed, again, more spiritual experiences in my life, since I developed an attitude that just like when I quit drinking and realized that was the way it was supposed to be, I wasn't supposed to be an obsessive, you know, self-indulged prick, right? I was that me not drinking and trying to help other people was really the way it's supposed to be. My life got infinitely better. When I realized that down there at GSSA, it happens exactly the way it's supposed to, another spiritual experience, my experience there got infinitely better because I've learned that this beautiful thing is about as close to a true democracy as we can get. And it's slow as hell. But the groups, everyone sitting in this room, runs the whole show. And that's beautiful, you know? everyone here, if you got a voice, it's going to be heard. You let your GSR know what you think, and she's bringing that message to us. He's bringing that message to us, and we're carrying it down to Macon, and it's going to the highest powers that be, because it's a really cool thing about this program that at the grassroots level, we run the show. And I'm going to say that I didn't want to be here when I came here. There wasn't even a little part of a hair on my left toe that thought it would be cool to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, I can't even find that same hair that would want to leave, you know? Because at the really bottom end of everything, if I want to hear the truth, I'm going to talk to other people like me who give a damn about me more than my feelings. Because that's what you guys did for me. You gave more of a damn about me than you did about my feelings. And you told me the truth. And coincidentally, it set me free. Because I thought I was living free, but I was just becoming more of a slave to my addiction. And so, I actually, on a weekly basis, cry some tears of joy. And me and a lot of the guys I roll with, we call them gratitude tears. And I don't want to quit having them, so I'm going to stick around. Thanks for letting me share.